Rob sent me an email today that cited a website of a news report. Where was it? I forgot where it was at.
Nigeria.
And on their soccer, and some official with the professional soccer association there said it was permissible for referees to accept bribes, but they shouldn't allow those bribes to influence their decisions. And so, you know, it was perfectly acceptable to take the money. And if people think that money's influencing your decision, that's perfectly fine. Just don't let it influence. So Rob gave me a dollar prior to this that he wanted the teaching to be extra good tonight. But following his email, I just take this as it has no influence whatsoever, other than I'm a dollar richer. So anyway, his statement was, perhaps this will become a standard for the NFL. And my response was, what makes you think it's not already? And then as we continued, I suggested that there should be lobbyists, just like there is in politics. And so if you have, when it's the Super Bowl, you lobby the referees, and perhaps you're for the Pittsburgh Steelers, or perhaps you're for, who was it, Seattle? But then perhaps you're like a Cowboy fan, and you're still bitter over the losses to Pittsburgh, and so you lobby in behalf. Yeah. So, or now Dallas makes Super Bowl, and you lobby against Dallas just because of Terrell Owens. So, I mean, it just opens up all new avenues. So, anyway, Rob ended up saying he was starting a chapter in Oklahoma for Tampa Bay. If you find Rob in jail for bribing officials, you know where it all came from. Philippians. Well, the fun thing about email is it takes longer to explain the emails than it does to actually generate them. In Philippians chapter 2, the last part, is really in the whole of Philippians is very different. And it's right in the middle. Romans has a section at the end of Romans that's very personal, that has a lot of interaction with names and people and settings. But this is in the middle of the letter. And just all of a sudden, Paul is into some very personal details. They have to do with the mechanics or the administration of this letter and carrying out some of the things Paul's talking about, but it surprises us at times, because we come to think of these epistles, even though we refer to them as letters, we don't really think of them as letters at all. We think of them as doctrinal treaties. It's the doctrine of the theological statements that God has provided for the church through historical writings. And these sections remind us very, very forthright that these were, real people writing to real people, or a real person writing to real people in a real time situation. And they had relationships. And so when you look at these on the surface, the tendency is kind of like looking at in narrative passages of genealogies and skipping genealogies, because not only can we not pronounce the names, it's like, well, what does this have to do with anything? And for somebody that's 10,000 years removed, it often doesn't seem to have much to do with anything. But if you were to think of it in historical writing, that means that's my grandfather right there. That's my neighbor's uncle in that passage right there. And in this passage, there the tendency would be to just skip this, saying, oh, well, this was nice, but it doesn't have any relevance. So the challenge tonight is, as we look at this, to say, well, nevertheless, even though it's about some housekeeping things, so to speak, this was still recorded by God through the agency of the Holy Spirit working through Paul and preserved for us. God had a reason for us to know this information. Why did God want us to know? What is there for us? So the challenge is how applying some of this. So we'll try to see if we can figure some of that out as we go through. The passage divides into two parts. The first part is Paul's plans for Timothy, for him to visit Philippi. And the second part is, in lieu of the fact that Timothy's not going to be able to come immediately, Epaphroditus will make a return trip to Philippi. He evidently is from there, was sent by the church at Philippi to see Paul, and now Paul is sending him back, but not just to return home, but actually to return a co-worker with Paul. Well, the first part, we could look at the plan in verse 19. Paul has a plan. His plan is, I hope in the Lord to send Timothy to you shortly. So he says, I hope. He says that again verse 23. Therefore, I hope to send him immediately. And then in verse 24, he says, I trust in the Lord that I myself will be coming shortly. So Paul uses these terms. It's almost a little more general for Timothy, saying, I hope. But with himself, he says, I trust, or it possibly could even be translated a little more definitely of, I am confident. But the key thing is both of them are in the Lord. These are Paul's plans, but he puts them in the sphere of the Lord. He is acknowledging from the very outset that these are perspectives, these are plans, these are thoughts, these are the way we see things unfolding, but we recognize that God is sovereign. We recognize that God may have another plan. And so it's not just a tag-on statement, which we from time to time tend to do, such as praying. We voice our prayer. We're saying whatever it is that we want to say. Perhaps we're praying an answer to a prayer, and then we say, well, if the Lord wills, kind of like, oh, yeah, we're supposed to say that. Well, Paul clearly isn't doing that. But just as he says in other passage, that, or as James says, we shouldn't be going somewhere, setting out our business plans, our life plans, in terms of saying, this is going to happen, and then that's going to happen, and then this is going to happen. In a very concrete sense, as though if I make those plans, then it will happen. So, there are all kinds of tools out there, both secular and within Christian circles, of writing purpose plans, of making plans, of setting goals for 10 years, 20 years, whatever kinds of things people are into. And all of those have a place and a purpose, but they're misdirected if within that you don't bring all that into that in. This is the perspective at this moment, but I recognize that God is sovereign. I recognize that God may have other plans, and so it's not as though I'm in control. So Paul is saying that at the very beginning. His desire is to send Timothy, but he puts that in the sphere of that his perspective right now is that's within the Lord's plan, but that is dependent upon that continuing and the Lord in truly unfolding that. And so within a short time, he wants to send Timothy. And he has two purposes. One purpose is stated very clearly. The other one is more of an implication within that purpose. His purpose is the last part of 19. I also may be encouraged when I learn of your condition. He's saying, I will be encouraged. But he's saying, I also will be encouraged, implying that they will be encouraged. So there's this mutual thing that when Timothy comes, evidently, the thought is that Timothy would return to Paul and that Paul would know about their setting, know firsthand what's going on, and that would encourage Paul. So he wants to send Timothy to check on things, to see how things are going, And that should be an encouragement to them as Timothy comes in behalf of Paul. But also Paul looks forward to finding out about it. Paul has a very much of a passion for these churches, Philippi being one of them. His heartbeat is for these people. He says in Corinthians that he talks about all the stress in his life. And he goes through that passage in 2 Corinthians where he lists all the outward stress that's come upon him at various times, how he's been shipwrecked, how he's been beaten, all of these kinds of things. And then he says, then there's the internal concerns about the church, about you. So Paul had all these external things, but he's almost like, but that's just a part of it because I have all these internal concerns. Not quite to the point of anxiety and worry, but there's this godly concern that's always gnawing at them. How are they doing? Where are they at? What do they need? And so Paul longs to find out. So he has those dual purposes, and then he gives some reasons. He gives at least, I guess we could say, three reasons here of why he's sending Timothy. Perhaps the reasons are given as we look at them, especially the third one, seems to be justifying a little bit his choice of Timothy. And we're at a point now of totally speculating because it doesn't state it anywhere. But possibly it would be that Timothy wasn't that well known to them. Even though Timothy was with Paul and Silas when they went through Philippi the first time, all the focus in Acts through that section is on Paul and Silas. So Timothy perhaps was standoffish or not as involved. We really just don't know. But for whatever reason, perhaps the Philippians just weren't that familiar with Timothy. But there doesn't seem to be any, we don't know of anything negative. We're just wondering why he feels he needs to give these reasons. Though on the other hand, maybe the reasons are self-evident. It's just one of those things one does. He begins first his reason in verse 20. The first reason is that Timothy is a kindred spirit. He says, "For I have no one else of kindred spirit who will genuinely be concerned for your welfare." What a statement. And it's a little hard to know fully what he means by that statement. He's going to turn around in a moment and send Epaphroditus, so we know Epaphroditus has concern. But is Paul saying this in terms of that he's upset with people where he's at because their focus is somewhere else? Or is this just highlighting the strengths of Timothy? But he says that Timothy is of this kindred spirit, this person of identity that identifies with Paul. They have similar passions, and he will genuinely be concerned for your welfare. There are a couple of things there in that statement. One is this identification with Paul, this similarity, this likeness. But it's not just that they have similar passions in general. Paul also moves on and says there's this very specific passion for the care of the Philippians. So maybe there are other people that are would have been passionate about ministry, passionate about going somewhere and spreading the gospel, passionate about being Paul's protege, but they weren't familiar with the Philippians. That wasn't a heartbeat of theirs. That's not a calling to that area. So we're not really sure how much negative you should read into the statement. For instance, we could come up with some place tonight, say VMI is put together this trip to go somewhere, and everybody in the room could be passionate about evangelism, compassionate just about exactly what this mission is, but not passionate about going to that specific geographical location. So, it's hard to know how much you read into the statement. On the other hand, if you take it at a very surface level, it seems as though Paul is surrounded by people that are totally focused on their own needs, which he kind of moves on and says, in one sense. Secondly, he says that he's been a co-worker. He's a co-minister in the gospel. He's in verse. Verse 21 continues the explanation, which seems to be a much higher indictment of those around Paul. He says, "For they all seek after their own interest, not those of Christ Jesus." Now that one moves it a step deeper. That it doesn't just seem like they're not perhaps passionate about one area. It's the very self-motivated, which is very intriguing in light of Philippians. If you go back to the beginning of chapter 2, where Paul is saying, don't merely look out for your own interest. Look out for the interest of others. And here he seems to be indicating that he's surrounded by a group that primarily seeking after their own interest, and not the interest of Christ. Yes. Yes. He is. I've taken it that he's in Rome. Some others would take it that he's in Caesarea. So it's a little hard to imagine what this setting is, but for whatever, we really don't know, and so we can speculate a lot, but what we do see in here is a very lofty view of Timothy. Timothy's not like that, at least. Timothy, we can see, has a genuine welfare or interest in their welfare. Timothy has a relationship with Paul that's very close. Timothy is concerned about the things of the Lord, not driven by his own selfishness. Secondly, that we could say of who he is, it would go along with that one maybe, is that he's devoted. That he is devoted. In verse 21, he doesn't seek after his own interest primarily. He seeks after the interest of Christ. So he's devoted to Christ. And then third, he is known. He is known by those at Philippi. And there are really three aspects to that, that he's known. In verse 22, it says, "But you know of his proven worth." So he has proven his worth. The Philippians are aware of the proven worth of Timothy. Perhaps, exactly where that comes from, we don't know. It could be back to their encounter with him when he was there. It could be because of his ministry in Ephesus. It could be because of the references in other places that have come through. But he's saying, you know about Timothy. You know that he's a solid person. You know that he has a proven worth. And he continues to elaborate on that. He says, he's been a co-minister. He's a co-worker with me in the gospel. And so it continues in verse 22. Says, that he served with me in the furtherance of the gospel. So Timothy has been a co-worker. He's worked along with Paul. And then thirdly, he's been like a son to Paul. More than just the father-son relationship in terms of that he was influential in his spiritual life. There's been a real mentor relationship, a very, very close relationship. And so the last part of that verse, he says that he served with him in the furtherance of the gospel like a child serving his father. Yes. It doesn't tell us. Well, he's not going to deliver the letter because the letter is being written and he's not coming, so he's not delivering the letter. Is he coming to follow up on the letter? Really the only thing we have, the letters to Timothy that when he was at Ephesus and he was placed in a position of authority to establish things in the church, to set up elders, he was being encouraged. I mean, that's what Timothy, the letters to Timothy are encouraging him to stand his ground often, not be intimidated, to be bold, to teach, to stand for truth, those kinds of things. So that's what the letters to Timothy do. This letter does not, I mean, this passage doesn't tell us. So you can project, you can speculate which things you've said would make sense. It wasn't for the delivery of the letter because he says he's not going to. He's not coming right now. Epaphroditus is going to have that role. And then Paul hopes to come shortly after that. But it seems to be the plan as when it finishes, all of this is subject to the Lord's own timetable, but Epaphroditus will come and he will bring the letter. That seems to be implied. That will be followed by Timothy coming, and that will be followed by Paul coming. So, what's the purpose? Well, Epaphroditus will come, but he's going to come as one of them. He's returning home. His level of authority is going to be minimal because they sent him, so he's not going to return with this apostolic authority, though Paul is definitely indicating that he should be respected and given some authority. Timothy's going to come in a higher step of authority, and so you might speculate that everything that's been written in this letter in terms of exhortation, that Timothy will be coming and saying, what's happened? Are we still fighting over these things? Still struggling with this humility thing? The passage later with the two ladies that are fighting. You mean you women haven't resolved this yet? What wasn't clear about what Paul said? Perhaps. I'm totally speculating. It does not tell us. I mean, it's a very good question. He doesn't state what he will be doing other than that his primary statement is that I will be encouraged. So, if you were to draw from that, if I'm writing this church a letter, and I'm saying Brett's going to come in a month, and I'm just so excited about him coming because when he returns, I'm going to be encouraged. But my letter is chastising you for the things you're not doing. The implication will be that you will change. Brett will come. He will see that you've changed, and he'll come back and tell me they've straightened all that out. They're not doing that anymore. That would be the best reading between the lines I can come up with. Anybody else got thoughts? It's a great question.
So, you might only be there for a couple, 3 weeks, but nevertheless, that is an extended visit where they get together, fellowship, teaching, and all those things. That when we would have an important guest come here, we would do those kinds of things. A revival.
Right. Right, it would not be reasonable to think that he's going to show up and they're going to meet together and he's going to get a report and leave the next day. And so implied in that teaching maybe that follows in accord with the letter. But I would say the main implication that I would draw from it is that if the letter, to the degree the letter is corrective, and it is, or to the degree the letter is directive, a visit by Timothy and a visit by Paul is, have you made progress? I want to hear that you've moved beyond that. If not, what's the point of even writing a letter? And Paul says, and I can't remember what the letter, which one it is, but he says, I think it's in one of the Corinthians, I'm not sure. you know, when I come, you know, it's basically when I come, I hope we don't have to deal with this. I hope this, you know, I don't want to come with a, you know, with a stick. I don't want to come in judgment and discipline. I hope you've already got this straightened out. That's why I'm writing ahead of time. But it's a great question, Becky, great insight in that we have this, you know, this passage here, but we don't have a this real clear objective. And so we're left at that point to imply. But then once again, I think we're seeing, you know, with those kinds of things, what you see is the nature that these are letters. And we really don't want the Bible written in the form that it's written. So what we really would like is if God would have written a systematic theology. And it, you know, and the times of Bible. Now why? Why didn't he just state it? Why didn't we just have this all in the form of theology? You know, God is, you know. But the majority of Scripture is narrative. I mean, these are much more clear than narrative. I mean, you read in the Old Testament, for instance, and you come across these passages, it doesn't even tell you that the actions of somebody is wrong. Now, what it does do is it shows you how the whole, you know, life and family and everybody associated with him was destroyed, associated with that, you know, and so you kind of get the picture, but you're kind of like, I mean, you know, us Westerners would be like, well, why didn't you just say it was wrong? And we wouldn't have to read these 14 pages to see what happened. But I think that's us, not the world, you know, I mean, in general throughout history. Then he restates, at the end of this, he restates his plan. And so he says in verse 23, therefore, I hope to send him immediately. And then the immediately comes, as soon as I see how things are going to be. So the immediately is not immediately. The immediately is in a relative time span. Because he says, I got to see how things are going to be. And that's a little, what does that mean? Well, Paul is very confident that he's going to be released from prison. But being confident, saying, I have indications this is what's going to happen, he still recognizes those aren't absolutes. So what does Timothy need to be doing? I don't know. Paul is under some kind of confinement. Timothy, you know, is his... runs errands for him. Timothy delivers messages for him. Timothy ministers in his behalf. It's very hard to see here that this has to do with personal things for Paul. I need Timothy to stay here, you know, to make sure that I get a loaf of bread every week. That would be too much of a contradiction with what he said earlier of why he's sending Timothy, because everybody else there is concerned about their own personal interest and not God's interest. So it would seem to be that whatever this is that Timothy is doing has to do with the service of ministry. And because of Paul's confinement, that it's necessary. So Timothy needs to be staying for a while. But he will send it. And then he says in verse 24, and I trust in the Lord that I myself will be coming shortly. So to use his terms, you know, Timothy's going to come immediately, but that doesn't mean tomorrow, and I'm going to come shortly. So that's the plan. Having said that, then in verse 25, he moves into Epaphroditus. He says, but I thought it necessary. Necessary implication being that necessary because I cannot come because I'm in confinement. Necessary because Timothy, whom I want to send, cannot come because there are needs here. There are things he has to finish. He cannot come today. Therefore, it's necessary to send to you Epaphroditus. And so that's the plan, to send Epaphroditus. But then he describes Epaphroditus in at least a fivefold manner. First, he's my brother. So he recognizes him as, you know, in this very much of a, the way the scriptures do, of this spiritual identity, that he's my brother. You know, we have a spiritual relationship in Jesus Christ. Secondly, he's a fellow worker. So he's a minister in various ways. He's a fellow. We share this in common. We do this together. He's a worker in the ministry. We're fellow workers. And then, having given that term, that's kind of a laborer, and so you look in you know, in the sense of a term of manual labor, you know, we're fellow laborers together. And then he goes, as Paul often does, he has no problem switching very quickly to another image. He's a fellow soldier. So on the one hand, we labor together. We toil. But we're also in a spiritual war. We're soldiers. And soldiers have a little different connotations. Yes?
Wouldn't it then be a logical conclusion to determine that he was not of kindred spirit, was genuine, not concerned for their welfare, and seeking after his own interest?
I granted. It's... you know, it leaves one wonder. Says, you know, you make this absolute statement, and then you talk about Epaphroditus as being a great person. So it's like, shouldn't it have been an exception? Timothy and Epaphroditus are the only ones. I agree. The only thing, you know, I guess one could say there in trying to read between the lines of Paul, why he wrote the way he wrote, is Epaphroditus is in a totally different classification because he's one of them. And so the assumption being, he's concerned about you because that's where he is. He's, you know, he's from you. He's not here. But, you know, I know. That's why it makes it hard to know earlier how strong we're to take that, how absolute we're to take those statements. So are they so much an absolute that nobody else is there, or is he using hyperbole to highlight who Timothy is? So if I read it on a surface, you know, just face value, Paul is surrounded by a bunch of selfish pigs. Poor guy. No wonder he wants out of prison and go to Philippi. I mean, he's sick of these, you know, he's in prison, plus he's surrounded by these people that are godless almost. I mean, they're Christians, but they're godless. Or he's communicating something about Timothy, and he uses hyperbole. So we are sending Randy to be the representative to in Arkansas at the youth camp because Randy has more compassion than anybody we've ever known for youth. True, perhaps an intended overstatement for emphasis. You know, I mean, we could do either one. I mean, one could be just actually true. Everybody else hates kids. That's why Randy's elected. Or the other one could be, you know, we're just a church with passion for youth, and that's how we speak about Randy involved in that ministry. Because we use intentional hyperbole to exaggerate to make our point. So I don't know. But it is funny. I mean, it does make for... One could, okay, you're sending us Epaphroditus, but he doesn't care about us, and he doesn't care about the Lord. He just is homesick. That's why we get this guy. He just wants to come home. So anyway, but it says that he's a fellow worker and a fellow soldier. And third, it says he's your minister. Or your messenger. And actually the word here is it's one of these interesting words. It's the same word that would be translated as apostle. That, an apostle is a sent one. So an apostle is a messenger. That's what an apostle is. But in certain contexts, clearly apostle has a technical language to it. And it means apostle in terms of not just just anybody. So is Paul here intending, as the translations here, that he's a messenger? He's you know, you sent him as a messenger to me, or is Paul intentionally using this word of lifting up Epaphroditus in his authority, saying, you know, he was your sent one, your apostle, your appointed one to me, and I'm sending him back to you as that appointed one. And then he says, beyond that, that he was sent as a minister. You sent him to me to minister. So I'm sending him back to minister to you in my behalf. So here's this a very lofty view of Epaphroditus, and maybe it's because, well, I can't say Epaphroditus seeks only after the Lord, but here's five good things about him. And I doubt if it's that. I'm just going to be facetious there. So a very high view of Epaphroditus. Then he gives the reasons. Why? Okay, this is his qualifications. This is the man. This is his character. But why is he being sent? Well, implied is he's available. It doesn't necessarily state that, but Paul's not available. Timothy not available. So it's stated, implied is that he's available. Secondly, he desires to make the trip. He's homesick because he was longing for you all. He's been longing. He's you know, homesick may be the wrong word. Homesick is a very self-motivated word. I'm motivated because I'm sick, and that's not the same as he's longing for you. He's desiring to see you. He's desiring to get back and share this information. He's excited about bringing this letter because this letter will be beneficial to you. You know, he has a passion for him, so he's desiring. Secondly, the second reason as it continues is, that there's a concern about his illness, and this will reassure you that he's really well. So Epaphroditus has been sick. He's been very sick. He was sick to the point of death. People get ill, and then there's that those certain situations where one is not sure what's going to happen. And there's some of those, you know, we go around and go, oh, somebody's homesick, they get the flu, and you know, you feel bad for them, you may pray for them, but there's an assumption, not a very, something that we get used to doing that we shouldn't necessarily do, but we just assume they'll be well in 2 days. But then we hear that somebody's really, really sick. And that was where he was at. He was at the point of death. And so that word has traveled around and it's been received back at Philippi, and they've heard that Epaphroditus was sick. Well, as Wynn was pointing out a while ago, if Epaphroditus or Timothy's going to make this trip, they're probably going to stay there a few days or weeks or months, because you don't just fly in and turn around and fly back. Well, neither did you send emails or call on the phone. So, you know, there's a pretty significant period of time between we heard Epaphroditus was sick, we've heard that he's better, the unsure nature of all that. Yeah. We heard he was dead. Now we heard he's alive. Which is he, you know? But lots of time in between. So it says here in verse 27, "For indeed he was sick to the point of death." Now this is a very interesting phrase here. "But God had mercy on him." So when he was healed, when he recovered, Paul puts it in terms of God had mercy on him. But that's not all. Notice how it continues. "And not on him only, but also on me." Epaphroditus was very sick, and God showed mercy to Epaphroditus by restoring his health. But that wasn't just mercy to Epaphroditus, it was mercy to me. And he gives his reason. "So I would not have sorrow upon sorrow." So Paul, you know, it's so easy, put it the other way, it's difficult for me to think otherwise, even though Scripture tells me that. But I just see Paul as this solid, stable person. And, you know, he's this duck in all water runs off his back. Nothing ever bothers the guy. He's just, you know, we got that picture of him in that Philippian jail, They put him in the inner dungeon and they put him in stocks and he's in there singing praise song. I mean, there's nothing bothers this guy. But in the letter to the Corinthians, you know, he uses terms that are along the lines of being depressed. He talks about all of these things that happened to him, but he has this inward burden. You know, it sounds a little bit like anxiety and worry. We assume it's not that, but yet it's close to it. You know, and here he talks about he has a sorrow. What would be his sorrow? Well, he's been in jail for a long time. He's got sorrow because he's concerned about churches. And then he's got this one, you know, not just the only person, but he's got this person that comes to minister to him from Philippi. They send somebody to him to help take care of him, to provide for him. And then he gets sick and he has this compassion for this person. And perhaps he has that sense of responsibility for him. Whatever it is, Paul says, if he would have died, I would have had sorrow on top of sorrow. Now, have you ever been in a situation where you could describe your situation as, I have sorrow. And something else happens and you go, I don't think I can handle anymore. That would be sorrow on top of sorrow. Well, that's kind of what Paul's describing. So when he says, God healed Epaphroditus or restored his health, he not only showed mercy to him, he showed mercy to me. You ever think about that in terms of prayer life? That somebody else is sick, somebody else is going through something very difficult, but because of your closeness, because of your concern, because of your care for them, it touches your life. And primarily, you're wanting God to be merciful to them, but you also recognize that if that prayer is answered, if they are experience relief, that you'll also experience relief because you have genuine care, concern, love for them. And that's where he's at. Then he gives as his other reason that his arrival will bring both joy to you and to me. Kind of back to that same thing. He says in verse 28, therefore I have sent him all the more eagerly so that when you see him again you may rejoice and I may be less concerned about you. Now, the implication could be, well, it doesn't seem to be here so much that I'll get this message back, but just the fact of knowing Epaphroditus is there, communicating, loving, sharing, that to Paul, that releases some of the burden for the Philippians because he knows they will have this letter. He knows that they will have a contact for him. Then he has some related directives that go along with this. So 29 and 30 says, receive him then in the Lord with all joy. So they're to receive him. That doesn't mean just have a party. That's, you know, he's not just returning. You know, we sent him, and now he's coming back, you know, from our missions. You know, Paul is saying, he's coming back from me, so receive him from me. So there's, you know, that's an authority issue here. Receive him. Recognize where he's coming from. Then it says, hold him in high regard. So not only receive him in this position, but what is your perspective? What is your view of him? Hold him in high regard. And he gives two reasons why you should hold him in high regard. First is he came close to death in ministry. Because of his devotion to the Lord, he almost died. And then almost the same type thing, he restates it, but just a little different. Because he risked his life for ministry. So because he came close to death, and he risked his life, and he was risking his life to complete what was deficient in your service to me. So there was an obligation on the part of the Philippians to minister to Paul. Not an obligation because Paul demanded it, not an obligation because Paul necessarily was somebody special that deserved it. It has to do with this spiritual relationship and response in terms of supporting people that provide. And so they had an obligation to support Paul. And so he says, there was something deficient. Timothy or Epaphroditus was the one chosen to come that you sent. And in doing so, he risked his life. You ought to respect that. Hold him high regard. And so he gives that directive of how he's to be received. The implication in the word, therefore I have sent him. How's the NIV have 28? I was going to look at that. Does it say sending? I'm sending? Or anybody have NIV? Okay. It's an aorist, which is a past tense, but usually interpreted here as being an epistle of Terry or an aorist of related to writing epistles, so it would be that perspective. So I'm writing this in the present, but you're going to be reading it as in a past. So when you read this, I sent him. You know, it's a past tense time you read it. And so the implication here is that Epaphroditus is the one that is going to bring the letter. So he's the one bringing the letter, will be followed by Timothy, and then followed by Paul. So in terms of application to the passage, I think one is we look at Timothy's life and look at the qualities, the character of Timothy. Regardless if this was an actual or a hyperbole, look at the characterization. Here's a person that has his interest are defined as he has interest in the Lord. What controls him is the Lord. Not himself, not the needs around him, but what is God's mission. You look at Epaphroditus. Look at the character describing Epaphroditus. A fellow worker, fellow soldier, a messenger, a minister. And so then we could ask perhaps ourselves, maybe that was become the application in terms of where are we? What kind of servants are we? Are we those that are willing to risk our lives for the gospel? Are we those that are willing to put the Lord's interest above our own interest? Any other thoughts or applications or insights or questions on this passage? We have prayer requests. Brad doing well? Is he back in school and apparently healthy?
Surgeon this afternoon.
We're good. Good. Other, yes. So pray for Gary as his ministry continues. Any news from your sister?
She started her new job Monday. So instead of sitting at the house, she's at the hospital on Saturday night. Got an email from her Monday and Tuesday. She sounds so good right now.
Yep.
She just wonder what's
the
reality.
Yeah. Okay. Other items? The only thing that I, as of Sunday afternoon, they knew where he was at, and there wasn't any, at that point, there wasn't any immediate plans for him to return home. And, you know, so it's not a good situation where he's, but. Yeah, they know where he's at. I think they had always suspected, but I think they had confirmation where he was at. And but they weren't going to go get him. And so not a good situation but not a missing, unknown missing child situation. A bad choice, not abduction. Which, who knows which one's easiest to live with, huh? Anything else? Your arm, side, still know it's there? Giving up on your son? No. We don't know. I mean, you know. For some reason, Dr. Luke did not write the third volume. You know, he wrote his gospel and he wrote Acts, but he, for some reason, forgot volume 3. So. Yeah. It would be nice to know, but it, you know, Romans or Acts, I mean, you read the end of Acts and it doesn't tell us. It just ends. I don't know. I mean, that's a good point. I don't know what Paul would be like in person, obviously, but, you know, looking at his letters, I mean, you have a person that when they did recently, a few years ago, what people do from time to time as the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, they came up with, you know, who's been the most influential people, you know. So you look at the last 2,000 years, listening that got pretty popular grouped Paul and Jesus together because of the New Testament, you know, they grouped them together as opposed to separately. Which we would take exception to doing something like that for certain reasons, obviously. But nevertheless, from a makes sense from the standpoint that the information or the influence is similar. When you look at that and you say, in a 2,000-year history, that Paul, even by, you know, just secular historian, would say is one of the most influential people the world has ever known. I mean, one of the very top 10, let's say. When you think of it that way, and you think of his authority that he was carrying in these churches, and you try to think of somebody that you've ever heard of or known that has authority, Paul's humility is incredible. I mean, you think of world leaders that are influential and try to think of them in terms of having that kind of compassion and humility, but yet having the responsibility to tell people, this is God's plan. This is where you're wrong. This is what you've got to do. Yeah, so, I mean, that would be it's pretty easy to do one or the other, but to do both of them and come across. So, at times you're going to have that, you know, where he's, very dogmatic. But then that part of it, remember, is the nature of the letter. It's a letter to people that he had a relationship with. And that's where we're kind of looking at from outside.